Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I am excited to be back here with our episode this week. We're going to be doing some things to close out 2019 and look forward to what we have planned for 2020, which is kind of exciting. So before we get into that, though, of course, nothing happens around here without Sam Bradley, the amazing and completely organized co-host that keeps me straight. So, hey, Sam, what's up?
I got you fooled, don't I, Jamie?
Well, that's
all
right.
Actually, producing this episode was a lot of fun because I always look forward to what you guys are going to come up with when we look at, you know, the episodes we did in 2019, which there were many and some very cool ones. And Colorado is actually warming up a bit. That big snow we had a week or so ago is kind of melting off. And I've got two meteorologists, so I don't know who to throw this to. We have our Kyle Nelson and Becky DePodwin. Kyle, I'll throw this one to you because Becky was on last week. So what's up with the weather here this week?
Well, Sam, good evening, and hello, everyone out there in Disaster Podcast land. Meteorologist Kyle Nelson coming to you. Yeah, Sam, we did have some pretty big snow in Colorado last week. Really helped to jumpstart the ski season and set us off nicely here. Ski and powder yesterday morning, actually, so it was fun. As far as weather-wise, at least across the western half of the U.S., we have another big storm system sliding in off of the west coast. It's going to be moving across the central Rockies here this week. That's going to be a slow mover, bringing plenty of moisture and snowfall, so get stoked for that. And also looks like a pretty heavy snowstorm in the northeast as well, more of a coastal storm, similar to the last event that we had just a couple weeks ago. So that's a quick look at the disaster weather roundup. Sam, back to you.
Very good. Thanks, Kyle. Becky, you mentioned something in terms of our what we're going to discuss later, but in general, you mentioned that eruption, and I only saw a piece of this, but there was a volcano eruption and a cruise ship that was very close by to that. You want to talk about that? I think that's kind of intriguing.
Yeah, it's a pretty sad situation, actually, Sam. So the place this occurred is called White Island, and it's near New Zealand, off the coast of New Zealand. And it's an island that is pretty popular with tourism, and people take helicopter tours and they take boats out to it. And unfortunately, the volcano erupted on Monday, and the latest numbers that I have right here as of earlier this afternoon are 30 people injured and 8 missing that are presumed dead. And then 6 people have actually already been confirmed as deceased. It sounds pretty horrific. People were, you know, obviously on the island to as part of a vacation, as part of being a tourist, trying to experience the volcano. They knew it was as active as it was, but a lot of burn victims and, you know, tourist helicopters going back in to pick people up. So just a really sad situation coming out of New Zealand right now. Just some of the passengers were from the Royal Caribbean cruise ship, which Royal Caribbean has had numerous run-ins with not being as up to date with weather information before. I'm sure just a coincidence in this case, but yeah, just a really sad situation. Not sure if warnings about the volcano were ignored, if people had any idea how close it was to erupting. A lot of questions to be answered.
Yeah, Joe mentioned in the sidebar here, there were a lot of concerns about ignoring those warnings. That's a lot more serious than I had realized in what little I've read. Jamie, you had a comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, they're still unable to even begin searching the island. It's too dangerous for responders to go there. They've basically, which is an interesting technology side note, they've been able to send reconnaissance drones to survey the area because it's too dangerous to even send manned helicopters in directly over the island. And what they found, they were able to spot numerous bodies that they think they found, I think, at least some of the 8 people missing, bodies covered with ash. So it's you know, there'll eventually be a recovery of some sort there. But right now, it's too dangerous for the responders to even go and do any kind of search and recovery mission at this point. And the injuries that were sustained were severe burns over, you know, they were saying most of the people had burns over 30% of their bodies because the people that were there, basically, they, from what I understood, they land and then they walk up and walk into the open crater of the volcano. So there were people actually hiking at the top of the volcano when it erupted. And so the hot gases and things like that probably were what caused the severe burns. But people were then evacuated by boat back to the cruise ship and then by helicopter from the cruise ship back to the mainland, or the island of New Zealand, as it were.
Good grief. Well, we'll have to touch base with our New Zealanders and see if they can give us some little more specific updates. I had no idea it was that serious. So, Joe, you wouldn't want to do a USAR reconnaissance up there on that volcano?
I would not. I'm not even sure how you train for that. wow. I mean, that's...
How fast can you run? That's what you're...
Yeah, and how are you going to cover that much territory in that much time? You know, it's such a... unexpected and unpredictable situation, and you know, the level of heat and rocks flying through the air and explosive force behind something like that has got to be overwhelming. So I can't imagine anybody being eager to go do a search there. Hopefully they can remotely do that with helicopters or something like that to get those victims out of there.
Well, you had mentioned again in the sidebar that there were a lot of concerns about ignoring warnings. Did these people not have a clue this thing was going to erupt as they're standing on the edge of it? I'm having a hard time with that one.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I know there was some talk that there had been some seismic activity around there and some warnings expressed that, you know, the chances of an eruption were greater, but very much like earthquakes, you know, we can talk about that all the time, but we certainly can't predict to the moment when that's likely to occur. So this is all part of the volcanoes and earthquakes go right together. So it's all part of the same challenge of trying to predict those fairly unpredictable events with the current technologies.
Well, that's certainly something we'll need to get more info on. Like I said, I'll touch base with our New Zealanders and see what they got down there. Another thing in the news, since we're just kind of on that topic, is someone in the community brought this up, and I hadn't noticed anything on it. I guess I should pay more attention. Is the measles outbreak in Samoa. There was a news thing that came up today that one guy lost his entire family to measles. What do you know about that, Joe? I assume they're not getting inoculated over there?
Yeah, I don't know a lot of details on that. I think it is safe to assume that the inoculation rates there are not great, and subsequently, you know, leaves people at significant risk of that disease, which can be quite devastating, especially among children. So it's another example of the power of vaccines, and that many of these illnesses for which we have ways to prevent continue to be devastating in areas that have not been able to take advantage of that that science and advancements in technology.
Wow. Yeah, we're going to have to do some more on that. Jamie, have you heard anything on that one?
No, I just saw a brief thing kind of floated by on social media, and I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. You know, it's a shame that something that was considered one of the biggest advancements in technology and medicine back in the mid 20th century have fallen out of favor for one reason or another, because they really have made such a huge difference in public health and avoiding diseases that are preventable. So I tend to kind of just, I don't know, I guess I've become hardened to cases, reports of unvaccinated people getting illnesses that could be prevented.
Yeah, unfortunately, the kids don't seem to have a choice in that.
Yeah.
There is an article posted in the community for those of you that might want to run over and learn some more about that, and we'll definitely talk about that when we get some more info. Another thing that's kind of coming up for us, since we're talking about 2020, is our friend Dan McGuire, who does a lot of critical incident management, especially on larger incidents, sent me some articles that he just completed today. Not today, but he sent them today, about, you know, the change from post-traumatic stress PTSD to PTSI, which is post-traumatic stress injury. And apparently there's been a lot of research on whether or not there's actual brain damage in long-term issues. And also they're looking at some treatments coming up. So that we'll get him on them the next few weeks. That ought to be particularly interesting since that's a topic we all have an interest in. So any other general thoughts from you guys, or should we jump in?
Let's jump in.
Lost my mouse there. Okay. Well, tonight we are, I've got to get the top of my list here. Okay. Tonight we're talking about our favorite episodes, and I noticed there were a lot that were duplicated. So we'll give everybody a chance to throw in on this. And Joe, we'll start with you. The one we just did with Andy Gienamp on the pending demise of many rural EMS services. What did you like most about that one? And I know you like Andy, so that's not a question.
I do like Andy a lot. We've had an opportunity to work together for a long time, and he is a very impressive guy. Unfortunately, I was not able to participate actually in the podcast, so I got to listen to it later, which was kind of weird. Nevertheless, I was so impressed with Andy's depth of knowledge. You know, he lives that very large expanse of Wyoming, and he loves it there. But, you know, I've been to a couple of his state conferences where there's 200 or 300 people in attendance. And he's quick to say, you know, this is probably half the paramedics in Wyoming that are here right now. And we're a huge state. So, you know, it just sort of brings home the scale of the vastness of states like that that are not very populous, and the real challenges of keeping people engaged, keeping them safe, giving them the best technology, overcoming the challenges of great distances to travel, communication challenges, skill maintenance, and all the different things that we think about when we talk about, you know, disaster medicine, because it's infrequent and, you know, challenges our skills, but we don't get to do it very often. So I think rural EMS has many of the same challenges that disaster medicine does. And I think that's what really, you know, made that one of my favorite episodes.
Absolutely. And I know that Kyle was with us on that one, and his eyes were bugged out through the entire thing, I think. In fact, Kyle, I believe that was on your list. What are your thoughts about Andy's discussion?
Yeah, Sam. So I really liked Andy's discussion, and it kind of goes into some of my comments that I'll share later on, but he was, and the phrase I'll use is disruptive with his comments. He really showed and just kind of took it down to the raw details and the raw truth of what's happening to our both public and private sector ambulance services and EMS services across the U.S., especially in the rural areas. And I thought it was awesome being in a rural county myself. Many folks don't think of Pitkin County, where Aspen is, as rural, but for the 1,000 square miles we have, the majority of it is very rural. And seeing how our EMS systems have evolved, and EMS systems where I grew up in Michigan, rural Southwest Lower Michigan, and it all kind of brought that back and to the forefront. And he put such a nice bow on it that I really thought that disruptive thought process that he shared and really that could really touch off some ideas going down the road.
I agree. And Becky, were you in on that one? Did you listen to that one?
I was not in on that one, but I didn't listen, but I did read some of the articles that went along with it. And it's fascinating. And I don't know if this was talked about or not. I'm not sure if this came out later, but I was reading an article about, this kind of ties in, but remote emergency room doctors. And I don't remember if this was posted or if I forget where I saw this, but basically it's in rural places that don't have a lot of medical services. They're starting to go more towards utilizing cameras and doctors who are remote to actually make diagnostic calls in these remote emergency rooms. Have you guys heard about this?
Yeah, that's kind of a thing, especially in those remote areas. I've certainly heard about it. Joe, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, certainly it's a good application of technology to, you know, expand the reach of what, again, are very scarce resources over very wide areas. We certainly do stuff like this in the USAR environment, and I think we're beginning to see it in EMS in general. I'm actually involved with several programs in my own personal EMS services that are beginning to incorporate telemedicine and the ability to put a physician out in the field to some extent, virtually anyway, to do some interventions and medical screening and maybe redirection of patients to more appropriate places besides an emergency department and an emergency ambulance.
Makes sense as something that might really help out that rural EMS scenario. Kyle, you had a thought you mentioned in there.
Yes, Sam, I know that's those telemedicine type things. That is increasingly being offered. I know here in Pickens County and the city of Aspen, they offer that to their employees to, again, help, as Joe was saying, offset that burden on local EMS services and emergency rooms to help to direct people to the most appropriate next step in their care progression versus overloading systems that are already very heavily taxed.
Jamie, I didn't forget about you.
No, it's all good. I know our health insurance has access to one of those telemedicine apps for urgent care situations, and they've had it for a couple of years. And this past year, I saw an article that the insurance company sent out with an urge for people to use the app. Basically saying that it had cut down on ER admissions or ER visits and costs because people didn't have to go to the ER when they had a problem that could, some kind of basic, easily diagnosed infection or something. I'm thinking of like pink eye or something like that, which, my wife had, earlier this year, she'd gotten an infection, and it was easy for them to call in drops to a local pharmacy and deal with that rather than have to go in, after hours to seek treatment when the primary care wasn't open. So I think those services are a good use of technology, as Joe said, but they don't take the place of true emergency care. And so they may take some of the load off of the ambulance services in the short term. They're not a solution for a long-term issue, unfortunately.
No, but like you said, it has its merit. And sitting in the ER is not the most fun in the world. I did that recently. But had to do that.
No, I mean, it's super handy to use. I mean, you're literally sitting there in your living room talking to a doctor. And if they need to, you can turn the camera on your phone and they can actually see you and ask you to, focus on something in particular, if they need to actually see something. But they're able to go through and ask the appropriate diagnostic questions and get answers. And then you've already entered your pharmacy information. So they just put it in through the app and it automatically gets sent to your pharmacy of choice. It's a great solution. It's certainly very valuable for what it can do, but there are lots that it can't do.
Yeah, well, it's a developing, we're all interested in medical innovation and technology, and that's an area that I can see growing, and they'll refine it, I'm sure. Joe, your other interests were clinical topics, which is interesting because you're the guy that always does them. But we love your clinical topics and your USAR dog wellness, which, of course, is always on my list. And having a wife that's a USAR dog trainer is certainly a part of that. We'll have to get her back on. You want to comment quickly on those two things?
Well, I'll be glad to. Certainly, clinical is my thing. I love the operational medicine of disaster, wilderness, austere environment, EMS. And, you know, it's just my passion to some extent. And, you know, the clinical side of dogs, that's a part of what the USAR docs have to do is take care of the dogs. So I get lots of experience around with that around the home. We have four, two of which are now certified USAR dogs. So, yes, my wife needs to come back on and talk about her journey from being a complete novice to a fully certified USAR search canine handler with both a live find and HR dog. So we need to get her back on and have her talk about her journey. It's been pretty amazing to watch.
Wow, and she did that all pretty quickly. Jamie, you had a question for Joe.
Joe, it occurred to me that I meant to ask you offline, but I can ask here on the show regarding clinical things. I mean, your research and things you're involved with cardiac arrest, survival, and cardiac arrest and CPR effectiveness and ventilation and all those things. I assume you saw the recent news item about the woman in Spain that was down for 6 hours and revived. I really found that fascinating and wondered where the science might lead based upon her particular situation, because nature apparently figured it out, at least in part.
I think that's a great description, Jamie. Yeah, you know, that also is one of my real passions. And I think we continue to push that science into some amazing places. I don't know a lot of the details of the case that you referenced. I'm looking forward to hearing a bit more about that. We certainly have shown in some of the animal models that we've been able to perform very high quality CPR for more than 30 minutes. And during that time, we have normal cerebral and coronary perfusion pressures and blood pressures and normal end-tidal CO2s, et cetera. So it's pretty apparent to me that with the right technology, training, and approach, CPR can absolutely provide very high perfusion states, which allow us to buy us some time in order to do more invasive interventions, such as revascularization or ECMO or some of those. So, you know, there's an awful lot of stuff happening out there. And I'm really pleased to be, I think, on the front edge of all that stuff.
Well, on that note, Kyle, you just posted a very interesting article concerning a 6-hour cardiac arrest event and hypothermia. You want to mention that?
Yeah, I think that's the patient that we were just referencing here. And it's so funny that Joe actually mentioned the technology, the ECMO. And that's actually the tool that was used by the hospital there in Barcelona to assist in reviving this female.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, hypothermia is a whole different animal when it comes to cardiac arrest. We could do a whole episode on that, right, Joe?
Oh, we absolutely could. Yeah, there's a lot of great science and innovation going on in that area for sure.
Becky, you've got a question.
So it's maybe my ignorance and not fully understanding how this works, but don't you give up after a certain point? I mean, 6 hours seems incredibly long time. I feel like there's a certain time where wouldn't you normally call it?
And well, she was actually she was hiking in the mountains and became hypothermic and eventually went into cardiac arrest. And
so it took them
6 hours to get her back to the hospital They kept her chilled and then used the machine to basically reoxygenate all her blood, and then they warmed her up. And that seemed to, according to what I've read, seemed to have done the trick. She has very minor loss of function, basically just tingling in her hands as an after effect, but otherwise seems to have had a complete recovery.
I think the headline was a bit misleading, but yeah, that makes sense.
He's like, Joe, your thoughts?
Yeah, just to add what Becky was saying, you know, I think there's a lot of things that we do now that are focused on buying more time. Hypothermia, or controlled temperature management as it's currently discussed, is certainly one of those things that buys us more time for other interventions. I think that the other thing that's important to know is that it's pretty clear that time itself is somewhat irrelevant, and that we focus on physiologic markers much more so than we used to. So we don't necessarily stop in 30 minutes or an hour or whatever, but we instead use things like end-tidal CO2 and a lot of other physiologic markers to give us a sense of how good the perfusion is and how likely that patient is to still have viability, or to help us in our decision to discontinue resuscitation efforts when they are clearly futile.
Yeah, Becky, paramedics have a lot, like Joe was talking about, markers. They have a lot more tools than we had years and years ago, when we basically had to do CPR on everybody, whether they liked it or we liked it. But that has changed dramatically, and the tools to determine viability have gotten much better. Becky, and speaking of Becky, your favorite episode was the preparedness lessons applied in Hurricane Barry, and that was Joe. So what did you, I mean, we know you like Joe, but what did you like about that particular episode?
Well, for me, it was making that connection of as a meteorologist, you make this forecast, and particularly when it's for a major storm and disaster like a hurricane, you sort of have some idea of what's going to happen, what the impacts are going to be, but then there's not a lot of follow-up except for the media headlines, and we all know how those can sometimes be over-exaggerated. So for me, it was really helpful and interesting to hear what it was actually like on the ground. You know, what goes into preparing, what kinds of things they saw as they were doing rescue in that situation. I just think there's so much on the logistical side of things that we as meteorologists perhaps don't fully understand or appreciate. And then obviously how our information is used when it comes to that type of preparation, and where people are sent, where they're going to be stationed, depending on how that forecast changes and when those decisions are made. And gosh, there's just so much to it that goes on after that forecast goes out that I don't even think we realize sometimes.
It's good to get the big picture. So, Joe, you want to take a bow and comment on that one?
Oh, I don't know if I can take a bow on that, but, you know, I'm certainly incredibly lucky and privileged to be part of that, you know, entire process of sort of pushing those boundaries and looking for new and different ways to make things happen and tying together areas that seem different and maybe unconnected, yet we have something to learn from them. So, you know, EMS, especially related to cardiac arrest, can be a very austere environment from the amount of resources that we can get there, and the ability to utilize some other technologies and approaches, et cetera, can hopefully make a difference in some cases like that.
Kyle and Jamie, thoughts from you on that episode?
I really loved that episode, Sam. I thought that was a ton of fun. And hearing, again, from Joe, the boots-on-the-ground perspective and what all goes into it, because largely, as what people see from the response side are the stories that are highlighted by the media partners that are there covering the event. But there's so much that goes on behind the scenes that truly for any disaster preparation or response that isn't highlighted, that isn't talked about, the unsung heroes, the logisticians in the background helping to do that, the planning folks helping to make sure everything runs smoothly throughout the day. And it all just ties together. And I thought Joe did a very good job of highlighting all those different aspects of disaster preparation and response.
And I'll just jump in and say that I think that one of the things that I've seen over the course of doing this show over the last 7 or 8 years, whatever it's been, has been I've seen an improvement in the logistics behind the scenes. I've seen an incremental change in the reports we've gotten from Joe and from other people, boots on the ground, that indicate to me, at least as I look back in retrospect, that preparations and preparedness is improving, and not both at the local level, but also at the state and federal levels as well, in that things are staged better. The incident support teams that Joe is going in with to help kind of coordinate the response with federal and state between federal and state and local resources. And I think all of that is an example of, how we have really worked hard to learn from each event and apply the previous events to the next event and then learn again. And I've seen that incremental change. I don't know if Joe, if you've seen it as well. It seems evident to me, just looking back at the various shows we've done here on the Disaster Podcast covering various hurricanes and other events.
Yeah, I think you're correct. We're seeing significant improvements in preparedness. I think it's taken a while, and it at the same time it's challenging to maintain system readiness and keep the technology up to date, especially when it's changing very, very quickly. And that's made, a real challenge for large bureaucratic organizations. I mean, there are several thousand people in the federal USAR system, and it's part of FEMA. And, like any large bureaucracy, it takes time to make things happen. So that's been a real challenge. We used to have very, very low reliability on cellular networks, simply because in the vast majority of disasters, back as far as the Katrina times and the many hurricanes around that era, there was simply no cell service for days on end, and that was just how it was. So we did not rely on that. Now, with drones and cows, cellular on wheels, and these mobile capabilities that the large wireless providers can now put into play, we can have cellular service, within hours. And that has greatly enhanced our ability to do what we do and transmit information and change the way that we do everything that we do. So, I'm sure with the advancement in drone technology, et cetera, we're simply going to see more and more and more changes related to how we transmit data and perform our duties in disasters.
Yes, and there's the fact that some of the larger providers are providing first responder priority channels. So those of us that need to get in and out to our families have the ability to do that. That's kind of a new thing.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Disaster Podcast. I want to thank you all for checking out this episode. We wanted to do this recap of our year and pick our favorite episodes. And so we're going to wrap up this episode there, and we'll pick up with more of the same next week as we get into our next guest's favorite episodes and lessons learned. So please come back for next week's episode. In the meantime, I want to thank Paragon Medical Education Group for their continued support of the podcast. Joe and Jim and the rest of the team over there do such a great job with some amazing customizable premium medical and disaster response education. You can't go wrong even just reaching out to them and finding out what they can do. They can customize things to your budget, to your needs, to your specific locations, specific challenges and disaster response needs. So please check in with them at ParagonMedicalGroup.com or through their links over at DisasterPodcast.com or through the Facebook group for the Disaster Podcast. And so we're going to wrap up this episode and look for us next week as we continue this wrap-up of 2019's episodes and lessons learned.